Good morning. I represent Andre Pulley. My name is Stephen Saltzman. What is in dispute in this case are, number one, whether the government was less than candid at a cooperating witness Anderson's sentence, setting up the quite rare situation in which a district court had to revisit a credibility determination she had already made for a cooperating witness, and two, whether that lack of candor by the government and its effect, in effect, stacked the deck against Mr. Pulley and made his sentence procedurally unfair. The result was that at Mr. Pulley's subsequent sentencing, the court found two inconsistent stories, both to be credible, and then ignored the sentencing factor, except for Mr. Pulley's criminal history, and sentenced him at the absolute highest end of the guidelines. In focusing on his criminal history regarding deterrence, the court gave short shrift to the reality that when persons convicted of a crime actually acknowledge their wrongdoing in the exceptional way that Mr. Pulley did, they have made significant progress in the reformation process. To answer the second question first, there are several reasons to find that the government's lack of candor mattered. At Mr. Anderson's sentencing, the judge was reluctant, and that was on November 13th, 07. The judge was reluctant to give him the one-third downward departure for cooperation. She, in fact, even after the government starts out by saying he's been truthful and he hasn't been a problem, one of which was absolutely not true and the other was less than candid, she says, "I will grant the 5K motion based on his cooperation. I have to say the criminal history is troubling, and I wonder if you can give me the government's position. Understand this is a very long-term pattern of illegal conduct involving fraud, deceit, forgery, and why I should take into account his recent cooperation in comparison to that long history and impose the agreed-upon sentence." And the government's response was that he'd been absolutely truthful and he hadn't created any problems. Well, at that time, the government knew that there was a disputed fact at issue between Mr. Pulley and Mr. Anderson that was going to likely result in the judge having to make a credibility determination. The government also knew at that time that Mr. Anderson had called the witness who had disputed his version of the events. He'd called her, and at least according to her, she felt threatened. He admitted calling her, so there's no dispute about that. And that certainly is a problem, given that people who are out on bond aren't supposed to be contacting witnesses. Two, another reason why this matters. There's no conclusion that's really possible that both Mr. Pulley and Mr. Anderson were telling the truth, as the court found. The tie that I talk about. Except as a means of confirming a prior decision. Because there was clearly different testimony on the facts. Who obtained the 544 West Melrose address to use in the Members Advantage Credit Union scheme and to get the debit cards and the Bank One check for $120,000? They're on opposite ends of that. Which one got Bank One to issue the check? They're on opposite ends of that one. Who picked the debit cards and check up and then deposited the check? They're on opposite ends of that one. Whose telephone number was it that it was listed on the UPS delivery slip for the Bank One check? They're on opposite ends of that one. So it's really not possible to make a determination that there's a tie. Another important point in showing why the government's lack of candor mattered is overwhelming evidence supported Mr. Pulley's position. None of Mr. Pulley's other offenses used the 544 West Melrose address or the phone number used by Mr. Anderson in the MACU scheme. Ms. Adams-Rutledge gave three statements that it was Anderson, not Pulley, who asked to use her address for the MACU scheme and then picked up the debit card and the $120,000 check. Anderson had used that same address, 544 West Melrose, in an earlier scheme against another credit union, only that everybody admits only involved him, at least that particular scheme. Although he claimed to the government that Pulley had given him the address 1 month later for the MACU scheme. In other words, he's saying, Pulley gave me the address for this MACU scheme. Oh, by the way, He never mentions that he'd had the address for a month because he'd used it in another scheme that he never said Pulley was part of. The handwriting evidence linked only Anderson to the MACU scheme, and the fact that Mr. Pulley's acknowledgement of other relevant conduct that made his guideline range worse is an important factor here in why the evidence is so overwhelming. There was a forfeiture finding at Mr. Anderson's his sentencing hearing, entered proposed by the government that Pulley was jointly and severally liable for the MACU scheme, even though the government knew, but the court did not, that Mr. Pulley's involvement in the MACU scheme was in dispute. There's an adverse reaction by the court to Mr. Pulley from his initial sentencing date, which is the next day, November 14, 2007, all the way until he's finally sentenced. The court, and at his final sentence, the court having found this tie, then ignores the important considerations raised in sentencing him to the highest end of the guideline. She ignores at that point that he had testified against his own penal interest. He admitted all this conduct. He had refused to admit something that would have, that if he had just done that, would have made his guidelines range lower. Because what he said, it wasn't true, and the evidence overwhelmingly supports that. She also ignored that the guidelines are no longer this bright line test, as the court well knows. District court has to figure out the guidelines range. But when you just get over one line, like the loss amount in the scheme that Mr. Pulley admitted, but the PSI had not found, that's the $150,000 affinity scheme, just put him over the $400,000, which resulted in a two-level higher guideline range. So if you look at the guidelines in that way, then Mr. Pulley was really would have been looking at a sentence of 57 to 71 months as opposed to 70 to 87 months. To turn around and sentence him to the high end of the guideline range was caused by the government's lack of candor and was also an unreasonable sentence given the factors that I've just discussed. I want to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sultan. Okay, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Dylan Smith on behalf of the United States. The whole premise of Mr. Pulley's appeal is that in sentencing him, Judge Kendall acted on some unspoken, unarticulated desire for some kind of face-saving consistency that is at odds not only with what she actually said in sentencing him, because there's nothing in the record to indicate that she is ignoring his arguments about extraordinary acceptance or holding the member's advantage dispute against him when she gets to applying the Section 3553A factors, but also is completely at odds with the entire way in which Judge Kendall conducted Mr. Anderson's sentencing hearing. She began what everyone thought would be the commencement of that proceeding on November 14th by noting, as she put it, that there was a fact dispute over Mr. Pulley's involvement in this uncharged members' advantage scheme. She flagged that issue at the beginning. She went on to hold a lengthy sentencing proceeding at which Mr. Pulley was represented, as he is here today, by very able counsel, who was permitted to cross-examine Mr. Anderson, the government's principal witness, and his co-defendant at some length. And at the end of that hearing, Judge Kendall found in Mr. Pulley's favor, to his considerable benefit, because what she found by concluding that the government had not sustained its burden to show his involvement in the members' advantage scheme was that he was entitled to his two-point credit for acceptance of responsibility. So the question became not whether Mr. Pulley was entitled to credit for acceptance of responsibility because he got that. The question was his acceptance of responsibility extraordinary, as Mr. Pulley would have it? Did it rise to an extraordinary level? And not surprisingly, on that front, Judge Kendall simply found, addressing this point head-on, that in light of Mr. Pulley's criminal history, I mean, he was, after all, criminal history Category 6, the highest under the guidelines. He had a history of committing similar frauds over a number of years against credit unions, that she wasn't persuaded that he had extraordinarily accepted. Now, on this claim that Mr. Pulley's acceptance of responsibility rises to the level of extraordinary, a little perspective is in order here. Mr. Pulley did not come forward after being indicted and say, you know what, you're right, I made a mistake, I'm ready to face the consequences of my conduct. He did not do that initially. He pleaded guilty only after his co-defendant had agreed to cooperate and testify against him, after he had received from the government extensive documentary evidence tying him to a number of these frauds, including in a number of cases with fingerprint evidence, so he had some fairly overwhelming evidence of guilt, and after putting the government through its paces to some extent. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mr. Pulley is fully entitled to exercise his constitutional right to mount a vigorous defense. But having made that choice, and at some point having made the tactical decision that the odds didn't look good for him, to have only then pleaded guilty, he does not sit in a particularly good position to claim extraordinary acceptance of responsibility, and it's not surprising that Judge Kendall rejected that claim. Now, specifically on the affinity scheme, and this is the $150,000 swindle to which Mr. Pulley admitted, and that did increase his guidelines range, there is an important question of chronology here that I think the Mr. Pulley's reply brief throws into a little bit of confusion, so I just want to clear that up. Mr. Pulley pleaded guilty on July 5th of 2007. And that wasn't pursuant to a plea agreement. His plea declaration pleads guilty to the charge, but doesn't at that point admit any relevant conduct. And what Mr. Pulley has touted in his reply brief is that he made an oral proffer to the government on August 30th of 2007, at which he admitted the affinity scheme. And he points out that that proffer predated the pre-sentence report and subsequent filings. What that overlooks is that the government's version of the offense was filed on July 27th of 2007, about a full month before Mr. Pulley's proffer. And that affinity scheme, the successful one, was flagged, albeit in a footnote, of the government's version. It was not listed as relevant conduct at that point, to be sure, but what would Mr. Pulley have known when he saw that in the government's version? Well, one, we know because it's in the government's version and it's part of the relevant conduct that was admitted, was that there was another attempted affinity scheme right around the same time for which there were fingerprints for Mr. Pulley. Two, in the government's footnote, this is footnote one on page nine of the government's version, there are a number of names listed that were used in connection with the affinity scheme. Two of those names are Sean Emery and Jimmy Morris. Sean Emery and Jimmy Morris are all over other schemes to which Mr. Pulley admitted and for which there was handwriting evidence. Sean Emery is, I believe, Mr. Pulley's sister's husband, as he admitted in his testimony at his sentencing hearing on August 22nd of 2008. So And Jimmy Morris is a friend of Mr. Pulley's. So it's a more than reasonable inference that when Mr. Pulley saw that footnote referencing that affinity scheme, that he did, in fact, see the writing on the wall. And some skepticism is in order with regard to this claim of extraordinary acceptance. And Judge Kendall certainly did not abuse her discretion in rejecting that claim. If there are any further questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll simply ask the Court to affirm Mr. Pulley's sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Salzman?
Judge, as to this proffer, I think the government misunderstands the significance. The government, because what it really goes to is the government's lack of candor. On November 14th, 2.5 months after Mr. Pulley had proffered to the government and admitted this $150,000 scheme, which, by the way, the PSI didn't find against them for lack of evidence, 2.5 months afterwards, the government lawyer stands up and says, Pulley has refused to admit anything that there wasn't physical evidence on, and there wasn't physical evidence on this $150,000 affinity scheme. And does that knowing that Mr. Pulley has made a proffer, Judge, in which he's admitted it. It just adds to the lack of candor here. Judge, I think that with respect to what the Judge Kendall gave me a full opportunity to present evidence. That's not the issue. The issue is was the court stuck in having made this credibility determination? And my answer is yes. She makes the decision doesn't make sense in the other way, given that there really can't be a tie between these two guys and the evidence is otherwise overwhelming. But when you look at the transcript, page 344 to 345, app 15 to 16, compare what the judge just said there, what the judge says there about Mr. Pulley with what I just read about Mr. Anderson's sentencing. Now, Mr. Pulley's criminal history shows he had a very long past of crime, and it's about 10 years. It's about 10 years of doing various petty crimes and more serious crimes. And I take that into account under 3553 when I am determining whether I'm going to protect the public from further crimes of the defendant. The history of this crime suggests that over those 10 years, he did not really learn his lesson, and so I'm convinced that he is extraordinarily accepted. Judge, when she asks the same question about Mr. Anderson, but he gets a third off of the low end of the guidelines. Mr. Pulley, and their guidelines would have been a little different. Mr. Pulley gets the absolute high end of his guidelines, and she's saying the same thing about both of them. The problem here, Judge, was the government's lack of candor set up this situation and created a problem that led to a procedurally unfair sentence. We'd ask that this court remand, and we'd note that we believe this case is much closer to Schroeder than it is to Pless, for reasons argued in our brief. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Salzman. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Chang? Mr. Salzman, I want to extend to you an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and so ably representing Mr. Pulley.
Thank you, Judge.
Case is taken under advisement. The court will